Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp. I'm here for the new, on behalf of the New Books Network, the Archaeology Channel. I'm here with Emeritus Head Archaeologist of the Jamestown Rediscovery Project, William M. Kelso. We're going to be discussing his new book, Jamestown, The Truth Revealed, More Remarkable Discoveries from the Lead Archaeologist to Unearth the Secrets of America's Birthplace. Welcome, Dr. Kelso.
Thank you.
So first off, I'd like to discuss a little bit about the cover of the book. Did you choose the cover, or is the cover assembled, or it's, there's a face and a map on the cover? Can you discuss a little bit, on how you selected the cover?
Well, the cover includes a little strip of a map that was made of Virginia, remarkably accurate, in 1608. Made by Captain John Smith, who people have heard about, I believe. And it shows all the, actually, 48 different Indian towns and villages, and also the location of Jamestown in the whole southeastern section of what is now the state of Virginia. And then the other part of the cover is a reconstruction of a skull that was found. I can get into more detail later, but of what I believe is sound evidence that there was, this is a victim of cannibalism during the darkest hours of Jamestown time period. And her name's, we gave her name as Jane, and this is a reconstruction based on that cranium, that skull.
So how did you come to be involved with Jamestown Rediscovery and the fort excavations, especially after evidence for such a fort had purportedly washed away into the James?
My interest and finally impetus to start a project looking for this so-called lost fort began over 50 years ago when I first came to the area. And I wanted to walk in the footsteps of John Smith and Pocahontas in this fort. So I went to Jamestown Island, and it was known that that's where the fort had been. And I went looking for it, and come to find out, a park ranger, a national park ranger, was there. And I said, where is it? And he points out in the river. And, well, what happened? He said, well, the shoreline eroded, and it's gone. So you can't really walk it unless you don't get wet. So I very disappointed. But I looked around, and there was a bank that, next to the river, an earthen bank, had been shaved back to show different layers of soil. And the top was on the top layer was this huge pile of clay that was put there to build a Civil War earthen fort in 1860s. Oh, that's interesting. And then under that was a dark layer that had objects sticking out. And I was not an archaeologist at the time at all. I was a student in history. But I saw it looked like colonial period things sticking out with a dark layer. And then under that were stone tools. and the labels on that, obviously Civil War, then there was this colonial period, and then there's before that, the prehistoric Virginia Indian period. So I looked at that dark layer, and it just caught my eye, and I looked at the ranger. I said, well, what about this dark layer? What's this? What's this mean? And he looked at me, and kind of, you could tell, yeah, I can't really answer. I'm not really sure what that is. So I thought to myself, maybe someday some archaeologist could come along and find out what that layer means. And 30 years later, I had become an archaeologist and had studied Virginia and other colonial sites. And I thought, well, on the horizon was the 400th anniversary of the settlement of Jamestown. And it was first settled in 1607. So we're looking at 2007. And this was in early 80s. I thought, put together a project and see if that dark layer has anything to do with it. Well, as it turned out, that was just the tip of the iceberg of the fort site being eroded away. But as it turned out, 90% was there. So my connection came in as I became an archaeologist working at Colonial Williamsburg for Ivor Noel Hume, the British archaeologist, foremost, during my great fortune, because he knew what he was doing. And he had written a book called Here Lies Virginia, good title, in the 1960s. And I read it, and in one page it said some burials had been eroded away out of that same bank. They weren't showing when I was looking at it. And he concluded that that was a sign that perhaps somewhere in this vicinity the fort would survive. Then through the years, he changed his mind, and then most everybody lined up and said, you know, forget it, you can't find it, the fort. But I thought, well, somebody's got to give it a shot. And so this is a long story. I can't read the whole book to you, but that site is part of a National Park Service site, but it's privately owned. And so I went to the owners and I said, look, I want to take a look and find this fort. And they had some stipulations and took 10 years to say, well, why don't you try it? So in 1994, the excavations began.
For our listeners, please briefly describe the provenance and impulses of the Virginia Company and the 1606 to 07 Jamestown migrants.
Well, I guess you must mean their goals and objectives, the company. Yes, and the same with the people that they sent. Well, this in the late 16th century, early 17th century in England, people were beginning to form joint stock trading companies, where not one person had to go out and venture all his money to go in an unknown place to make a profit with whatever he found. So the idea was, and I think a man by the name of Captain Bartholomew Gosnold, he'll come up later, he'd already tried to put a colony in what became New England in 1602, and he thought then that was too far north, too cold up there. But he got in an idea to set up a company, to set up a colony for the company in Southern Virginia, which was where the first English settlement really was put, in the James Fort. And he got together Smith and some other leading people. And he also had connections with the crown and was given a charter in order to settle, because King claimed the whole North American coast, basically north of the Spanish border. So they were granted this right to do that because one of Gosnold's relatives was a favored courtier with King James. So good. Okay, you got the charter. And then they needed the money. And another acquaintance and relative was a very rich merchant who had made money on these joint stock companies going actually into going east of England. So he got the money in order to outfit three ships, 104 sailors. And they were basically employees of the Virginia Company that was ruled by a council. And they sent with them one governor to run it, to run the place. And they were to go and find all the gold and become rich quick. And once they got to Virginia, but anyway, they had to find a place, and that's another story.
If you can, please concisely narrate, tell the story of the early history of Jamestown, perhaps beginning with the Black Ball departure, as well as your critical reassessment of descriptions and three maps from the earliest years of the colony, and perhaps addressing the construction and reconstruction of James Fort, Native encounters, diverse others, and the starving times.
Well, in December of 1608, the three ships that were outfitted for the company with their just over 100 settlers that were going to stay and establish this colony left east of London from Blackwell Stairs. And they had figured it would take them 5 or 6 weeks to get to Virginia. This was not the first time Virginia had ever been discovered by sailors. And so the problem was that the winds weren't right, and so it wound up taking them 5 months to get there. So on the way, they're using up their provisions just to stay alive in 5 months. And got to Virginia, and they were told to go 100 miles inland to hide out from the Spanish, who were not too excited about the fact that this other European country was going to claim land in their Florida, as they called it. So, so they were instructed to go 100 miles inland, and they immediately tried to go in upriver, and of a major river, which the James River is a major river, and you go in the Chesapeake Bay is an amazing natural port. So they found out really quickly that you can't go 100 miles with those ships because there's waterfalls at Richmond, which is only 50 miles. So the backup plan was to find some island that was strong by nature. And what that meant was he's got this water around an island and that there will be defensible against the Spanish. And what it turned out, it needed to be defensible against the 15,000 Powhatan Virginia Indians that were living all over the place in that region. So anyway, the geography of the James River, and that's what they called it, although it had been by the Indians called it the Powhatan River. Anyway, it became the James River to the English, and they settled. They found this one island, basically an island that was about the right size, and there aren't others to choose from along the James. So it became Jamestown Island, and there. They, after scouting around for two or three weeks, they didn't just sort of jump ship when they saw the land. I mean, they studied and they had instructions from the company. So they went to the island, and on May 13th, 1607, they unloaded the ships, and they said the reason we chose this was because we could tie the ships to the shore from the channel. Well, that's another story why people thought the fort was lost. Everyone assumed they built the fort right there, but they didn't. As it turned out, they marched up to the highest ground. So, okay, there right away there are some skirmishes with the local Virginia Indians, and they were also instructed to not settle in a place where you wouldn't have any Indians living between you and the ocean. Which you can't do. I mean, they had gone by several villages just to get there. So anyway, they were then under attack. 20 of the men went up the river to look for gold, and 20 were assigned to build a fort. And they had to do it quickly because they had one major attack. So in only 19 days, they put up about an acre. They put an acre behind palisades, they were called, that is side-by-side logs planted in the ground. logs that had to be cut and dragged and put up. And so it was really a Herculean effort to get this fort up that quickly. But they had incentive because they were under it. The Indians were firing whenever they could, arrows. And so, so James Fort existed, but soon after that, you've got a rash of deaths. And one of the journal writers of the time said, just the stress of putting up that fort in the Virginia summer, which is could have been 100 degrees humidity, and these guys are dressed in wool, if not armor. The fact that they could put that up that quickly, many began to die, and they died of starvation and bad water and illnesses, so that by the end of August, they were down to 38 out of the 104, which they were technically. 38 only left alive. But the fall, things got better, and then more ships came in. There is another almost time when the colony is going to fail completely a couple years later. And we'll talk about that too. I think it's in the book in there too, that it had such an effect on the archaeological site. But it lived on as long as John Smith was there. Then he leaves in 1609, and too many people came over without food, and then they had this huge starving time.
I guess ahead to 1990, going back to 1994, I guess going ahead, what factors, including extant maps, led you to make an educated guess as to the site of the fort for quilt method excavations, and who joined you in these excavations?
Well, I had the luxury of at least a year to plan out how I was going to start, how I was going to do this and where to start. And because we had 22 acres to find this fort, and that's a big area when you have a small shovel. So I know there were three maps that vaguely locate shows where the fort was located on this not very well drawn map of Jamestown. In fact, one of the maps shows all of southeastern North Carolina and what became North Carolina and Virginia. So it was just this little symbol. And it was in another one the same way. It was just this little tiny symbol. It looked like a dot to me. And it looked like it was on the part of the island that probably they could have washed away. So I was a little uncertain, you know, when we began, but it was clear that it was on the western end of this 1,500-acre Jamestown Island. So there are then descriptions of the fort, but not drawings. Well, by the other map, by the way, if I had been able to read that like I've read it since, it would have been, you know, like no problem. You know that's where the fort is. But anyway, you couldn't do it unless you saw the original, which was in the British Library. Anyway, that's the location. Then the one above ground remnant of Jamestown built environment is a church tower from the 17th century. Everything else went down, and there was a fairly steady population in the town after it did make it and so on, but that's another story. Anyway, I thought, well, maybe they didn't build where they could, they being the settlers, tie the ships to the trees. Maybe they went somewhere else, and maybe on this high ground. And they did have a church that was recorded, that was in the record. So maybe that tower has something to do with the church. And I'd been traveling some in Europe, and every church, if you go under down in not the basement, but underneath them, especially in Israel, there are eons of churches that were built there and rebuilt there and rebuilt. So I thought, well, maybe the original church was somewhere near this tower, and maybe the tower's not that old. So taking the one description that gives some dimensions to a triangular enclosure, I made a drawing of it and scaled it to the land and put the tower in the middle, you know, and thought, well, maybe if we dig down between the tower and the river, we might see some evidence of that original fort, which lasted 20 years, first 20 years. And so the first shovel goes in the ground about here. You know, I said, well, tower's there. The riverfront is along here. And I was consulting with Noel Hume at the time, too. And he was saying, well, you know, I think it's somewhere on the island, but another place way away from there. But he said, we ought to check this out. I said, okay. So put the shovel in the ground near the shore, river shore, about far enough from the tower to say, well, if it's a 1-acre fort, then this would be about as far as it could be. And I was able to get a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to support the excavations for probably, it would be 2 years. And I was able to hire for a short time all of the best archaeologists I knew, senior level, just to come for a week or two, and they did. And as it turned out, the wall was almost where we put the first shovel in the ground, the south wall along the river. But where we did put the shovel in the ground, began to find objects, military objects, coins old enough. So it's military. It looks all military stuff, mostly military stuff. And so that was a good deal. But we had 10 more years of excavations to be able to prove that that's the fort.
So what post-hole soil material culture footprints indicated that by 96, your team had discovered the South Palisade Trench wall and the curved bulwark trench and its accompanying ditch. Why were these footprints, as well as early dates and the military nature of the artifacts, compelling evidence that you had actually found the remnants of James Fort? And if possible, can you briefly provide examples of such artifacts?
Well, let me back up this couple questions there. One is, what would we find that would tell us that here's a fort wall and here's a fort building and all, if in fact they were all made out of wood? And that was the challenge. But here in this region, there is a level, we call it subsoil. It's clay that was really at the bottom of a millions of year old ocean, had been on the site, you know, millions of years before. So, and that's under everything. And that's just a uniform color of soil. Well, I knew that this is a palisaded fort. So you'd have to have a trench deep enough to plant these upright logs side by side. That's a palisade to make a wall. And then wherever the colonists dug deep enough to go into that subsoil clay, it changes the mono color of it all, and it's mixed. It's mixed soil. You can't put it back the same way it was. So all of James Fort, really, most of it is not masonry. We're not finding solid foundations with two exceptions, but we found where this clay had been disturbed in a pattern. So the whole key to this was pattern recognition. If we looked and we saw a discoloration that's about a foot wide, and it's going, it was found that it ran across, not ran, but that it traversed across an area where we dug down to the soil, dig the next trench or the next square. And I often said, this is like, you know, building a quilt. If you if you began to one patch of a quilt, you can't see the pattern. But if you add them all together, you begin to see that there's a pattern to it. So we would, what we call, follow these stains, these soil stains that were created by colonial disturbances. And following that for about 10 years, because it takes, you can't just rip the soil apart. You know, you've got to go very carefully. And it takes experience to be able to see these soil stains. Then that was telling us, and I thought the best thing to do is to find the triangular wall. If it was triangular, I mean, that's just triangular what? You know, one said it's triangular wise. Well, what does that mean? But anyway, that it would make a triangle. So I felt that we had to find the three sides by following these soil stains. And then it would confine the space to a diggable space that you could actually uncover, especially by 2007. So, and there was a big anniversary coming up. So, okay, that's what we did. And it took about 10 years to connect all of those dots and dashes. Some are post holes where somebody wants to put a post in the ground and not a line like you would on the wall. Then a hole is dug bigger than the post, of course, deep down, set the post in it, and then put the fill back around it. And that makes a stain. And then they began to build buildings based on these posts in the ground, spaced out every 10 feet or whatever they were. And then once it makes a rectangle, that's a pattern. And you began to see that this is where a building stood. And also, another place could be a big discoloration, a lot of artifacts sticking out, and you dig down, it's a well or a cellar in a building or and so on. So that was the key. And it's following these soil stains. And then in the artifacts that are buried when the post goes up or when it's pulled out or when the palisades were put in, and they can be dated to a certain period, and that's done by analogy, by looking at other collections that are dated and so on. And fortunately, we found a few dated coins, which gives us a real exact date. Then we can see what dates to the fort. And Jamestown was occupied, as I mentioned in the beginning, well into the Civil War and up to the present. It became a park, and there's all kinds of deposits from these different time periods. But our goal was to find the earliest, which would be not necessarily the deepest buried, but these disturbances that are sealed over, as we say, are filled over by Civil War fort, for example. Under that would be actually the black layer, which was there was plowing out here after you get into the late 18th and early 19th century at Jamestown, it just becomes a farm. And then under the plow zone, we find this subsoil. And so the layers could be sorted out and dated that way with careful digging. And it takes experience to see these things. I think it's more, in a way, it's more of an art than a science, much more of an art. It's color and texture and things that are hard to quantify. And so therefore, I don't think that science can do that. Anyway, that's another topic.
How did you find and date the east wall and north bulwark, especially given the discrepancies with William Strachey's description, which I think was your fort model? And then this is a two-part question. Second part, why did a test search trench 40 feet from the 1617 well, where your model predicted the fort west wall would be, in fact, revealed said wall?
I'll go to the second part that I can remember right now. We were able to trace a wall along the river until it actually went into the river. So there was a piece of this fort that had washed away. Then the trick was, and we'd found an east wall. Wasn't that clear, but it was an east wall. we're speculating. Basing our decisions from there on that was the East Wall. So it wasn't clear exactly how big the fort was or if the dimensions given were accurate. So we went beyond into the west looking for this trench, this palisade trench going north, and found a well. And that was interesting. And so we excavated that. We found it had been filled in probably after 1610, maybe later, based on the artifacts that were thrown into it after it was abandoned. And there's a pattern to that. We found several wells, and that's what happens to them. So anyway, then we felt, well, the Civil War fort is sitting on undisturbed proper land except for the plow zone. So we began working to the east. We moved, in some cases, 10 feet of fill on top of where we found the undisturbed layer that dated back to the 17th century. And we, luck would have it, we were digging too far. I thought the well was maybe in the center that we found, and it would have made the fort huge, you know, but if the well is in the center. But going back and just double checking, we did find a piece of a palisade that we traced out for 2 or 3 years under the fort. Under the Civil War period earthwork fort. So anything that, as it turned out, any signs of James Fort that these earthwork was built upon was more or less preserved, whereas outside of that, to get the dirt to pile it up for the Civil War fort, that area was graded down. So we found this well, and it was about 1 inch down to the brick lining from the 17th century. And that's because the top soil and the plow zone and all that had been graded away or taken, that dirt was taken in to build up the other fort. So that's, and once we found the west wall, it was, you know, a piece of cake.
If possible, can you please provide a couple of examples of evidence and artifacts from James Fort structures, such as the barracks, you know, like starving time food remains, the quarter, the factory, including the dungeon, the row houses and gentlemen burials, and the Smithfield well, 50 feet outside the west wall, cellars, and then the building sites that revealed evidence of a Native American presence in the fort. I thought that was especially interesting. So just provide a couple of examples of evidence and artifacts from James Fort structures.
Well, we found, I think it's a total of 9 structures that have been built inside the fort at not all the exact same time, but several that were built immediately. And one was, we think of barracks because it was 20 by 50. That's a big building. How do you know? Well, the post hole pattern made a rectangle that was 20 feet by 50 feet long. There was some evidence of a chimney in there, although it was wooden, if you can believe there is such a thing. So this was, in the beginning, Jamestown was a military base. So you begin to find things like a barracks where you put the troops. And then we found footprints of the blacksmith shop, which was established, according to record, right away in 1608, and it was below ground. And that was really, really interesting because that's the first iron working in English America. And then inside another post pattern that showed where the first church was. So I was wrong about the tower. This is 40 feet to the outside, beyond that. Going to record, we knew the size, and the postal pattern made that size. We found 4 graves in a place which would have been the chancel. So, that's the kind of evidence that was turned up. And then the pieces put together on a master map. And now we have Now we have a map of the fort pretty much done. I mean, it's about 90% excavated. That either never was made, an exact specific map, or of the plan, of the, what we call the first town plan in a sense. By putting all these pieces together through the years. Then the second part of your question is, I'm trying to, can't remember.
Yeah, just a couple of examples of artifacts that you found, like the Native American presence, the dungeon, etc.
That's really important. So what we found were the fact, it must be the case that Jamestown, there were many buildings built in a well sunk in the center of the fort. But Jamestown was heading towards a disaster. And by 1609, this is a couple of years after the fort's established, going into the, in 1609, about 300 or 400 people come in with no real provisions because they'd been hit by a hurricane and they'd been all spoiled. And there was very little food anyway for the people that were already there. And started into a winter time. Studies have shown that there was a major drought going on during that time. So even the Indians were suffering from food. They couldn't get any food from the Indians. And they actually besieged the fort and wouldn't let the settlers out, at least off the island, to hunt and fish. So they couldn't do that. Then disease hit, and then there was bad water in the well. The salinity levels go up as the salt water from the river begins to creep in. At first, the wells are drawing on groundwater, which is fresh water, and then that's kind of driven out. The more you use the well, the more in comes the salt. So it was kind of like a perfect storm for starvation. And at the end of that year, of 1609, there were 60 left alive, according to one account, out of maybe 500, maybe 220, depends how you count it. All these people had just starved to death. In fact, things were so bad that when the governor finally came in from having been shipwrecked on Bermuda in the spring of 1610, they spent a week or two looking for food, couldn't find it. So he packed up everybody that was left, and it wasn't very many, but he had people with him too. And they start sailing down the James. Well, miraculously or not, depending on how they would consider it, the company had realized that they needed to really supply these people or they would die. Well, they were dying. So in came, under the command of Lord Delaware, Sir Thomas West, who was a real governor sent by the company. The other leaders were not really authorized much to do much. And so they came in with healthy people, soldiers to help, provisions for a year, 1610, and so the company who had left the island going down the river, sailed back, and I always think to myself, boy, but they were excited to come back to that place. They came back, and the colony, from that point on, would be permanent. So it is true that this is the first permanent English settlement in North America, at least, from that point on. There were other starving times and other problems, but never as bad as that one year. And how we know that is the well was filled in, all the cellars from the buildings we had found were all filled in with material that had been accumulating during the starving time. It's pretty clear because in it were butchered horses, dogs, bones, snakes, rats, things that wouldn't be on the menu normally, would it? So during the starving time, they're eating everything, including occasionally each other. So anyway, in these pits, when so many people are dying, all of their possessions that they brought with them are just trashed and thrown away. So the next thing we knew is when we dug into the original storage cellar well, we came up with over 500,000 artifacts from that first 3 years that were just, you know, they're still usable, and were still usable and thrown away. So it's military, you know, weapons and pottery, glassware, things, some things not even broken, you know, I just, goodbye. And we found that in that cellar well. Then we dug and found another cellar that is dug into the dirt, down for some feet now, a kitchen that, according to record, was built in 1608. We didn't know where or what it would mean to, but there was this pattern, and there was a cellar, and in it was more of these of this material that apparently Delaware said he came in and he cleansed the town. Well, he probably got rid of everything that would remind anybody of the starting time, and that he threw them in these cellars, and they quit building like that. They started building above ground where it wouldn't get wet. So in that cellar were the butchered bones and horses and other things, just like the other ones. And there were several like that, building cellars, that is. And in this, in one of the layers is where we found Jane, who I've already mentioned her, which is quite shocking in a sense.
For our listeners, can you, before we get to Jane, can you briefly address the estimation and attempted skeletal DNA matching of the remains of a man who most likely was the Virginia Company's Captain Bartholomew Gosnold, who died in August 1607, found near the 1617 well outside the West Wall, near additional burials?
Well, as we were looking for the West Wall and found this shallowly buried well, we found what looked like another well. There was a circular deposit of oyster shells buried. So we started digging that to see if that would say more about the fort. And we began to see a soil stain. It was about 2x6. Rectangular that looked grave-like underneath all these shells. And so, well, that's interesting. So we said, well, we need to excavate this to see if that's going to lead us to any more evidence of the fort. And as we dug down, we found it looked like a spear. It had a metal point on it and where a wooden handle had a spear. Like object had been laid down and buried. And then under that, we found evidence of a coffin. And under that, we found the remains of a male who died at age about 35. You can tell that by bone development in remarkably preserved state, which I think the oyster shells had something to do with the calcium. But who is this? And at the time, we felt that he was buried with this ceremonial staff laid on the coffin. So come to find out, one record suggested, and now I've re-looked at this again, but anyway, suggested that this is something a captain would carry, like in front of the head of the troops with his captain's leading staff. So here's the captain. In the fill, there's it's clean fill, as we call it. Somebody went in really quickly, and we know that I always know that Bartholomew Gosnold, the first leading prime mover of the whole settlement originally, died August 22nd, 1607. So he didn't last long at Jamestown. And I thought, well, who could this be? So we had been working with the America's foremost forensic anthropologist, Dr. Douglas Owsley at the Smithsonian. So he comes down and looks at these and analyzes what he sees. And he said, well, according to bone development here, this person died at age 35 or 36 because he's in such good shape. You can see, you can really tell. of that he would be about that in that range. And well, the records indicated that Gosnell died at age 36. Well, I thought that was pretty interesting. And then I thought, well, is there any way that can DNA survive? And I'd read that it can, you know, ancient DNA. And Doug said, yeah. Yeah, it can. And I said, well, let's take this as far as we can to see if we can if we can identify this person. So DNA tests were done. It was found. It was minimal and degraded, but according to the lab that he works with, it was enough to that if we could find a living relative, maternal line, that is, from Gosnold's mother down, from him down to the present, then we could identify, it's called mitochondrial DNA, and that we could possibly identify. Well, there are some great genealogical researchers in England and contacted them. They did the best they could, but they couldn't go but maybe two generations forward from Gosnold's sister and his niece, who would have the mitochondrial DNA if we had the mitochondrial. So, make a long story short, finally got permission from the Church of England to test two of these two graves that appeared to be where the sister and niece were buried in churches. And that was a long process of getting permission, as you might imagine. But anyway, to go and get samples from where they're most likely to be buried. So we did, brought the sample of the we couldn't find the niece, actually, but we did find the sister, we thought. Brought that back. Same lab did the test. They looked at the DNA, and it said it does not match. And so what do you do with that? Well, that's really a problem, because is this really the sister? She wasn't labeled. Or is this really Gosnold? And so if it matches, it's great. But if it doesn't, it's just all kinds of questions about, you know, who is this person? But it was worth doing. Because now we're doing it extensively on other burials, and it's getting more and more sophisticated. In fact, a male line can be traced, which we couldn't do at that time that I understood. So at any rate, we still think we've got Gosnold, and there was a test called the stable isotopes where you could tell from the teeth where a region where people were, when they were growing up and their teeth were being formed in early years. And that said that this, our burial did come from that region of Suffolk, England, where we tested for the sister. So that, you know, that's an indication that we've got the right person. But now we're going to do another test and we'll see. And one other thing I want to speak to, you had mentioned the presence of Indian material in the fort. That's probably the most surprising discovery of this project, other than finding the fort and finding a cannibalized.
Yeah, I thought that was really compelling.
Yeah, with the English material, not anything that was buried before they got here, got to Virginia, were these thousands and thousands of Powhatan Indian artifacts, many of which were things that show that whoever was here were making traditional Indian beadwork, pottery all over the place. The most extensive collection by far that's ever been found at any Virginia Indian site. So it was obvious that there were Virginia Indians on both sides of that palisade, and they lived. And they were camp followers, I guess. These are all men. There's, you know, the women are usually the ones that make the pottery and the beads. So, you know, they were in there. It suggests strongly. And that's a different outlook on the them and us story of America, you know, early America. It's just more, as we always say, it's just more complicated than that.
Please provide evidence that the settlers followed or somewhat followed Virginia Company directives.
Let me see. There's a list in the book that I thought you could kind of strike them off. Wherever they could, I think they did. Geographically, again, they were supposed to go 100 miles up the river and they couldn't do it. The geography wasn't right. So they compromised and they went to an island to settle. They were... just a minute, I got to get my list up. Okay, here we go. Their location, again, I mentioned they chose an island, but they were supposed to find a wholesome and fertile place. Well, Jamestown Island, there's an awful lot of low ground here that are marsh, and that isn't very wholesome, and that was a problem to them. For defense, they chose an island. They did settle on a major river, so there was transportation. For defense, the scouts should be stationed at the river mouth, but they put another settlement down at the Chesapeake Bay entrance. And they were also told that if there are any deaths, that you got to hide it from the Indians finding out, because they'll see that you're one thing mortal, and another thing, you're in trouble. So we found the first summer burial ground was right inside the fort, which is really not what Western civilization from Roman times anyway would do that. But they were doing that to hide them out. And then they were told to plant. We found evidence of planting roads and farming. There's a whole list in the book about the cultivation, the economy, and the governance, and where they followed and where they didn't, and how diligently did they follow that? And I would say that the English into this foreign environment, this hostile environment, began changing their customs and their society almost immediately. So these are Americans, or Englishmen inventing Americans. You know, I mean, that's how you're going to have to live in this whole different part of the world. It's so different than England. And the climate and, you know, the fauna and the flora and everything is just alien to them. The company, of course, they're sitting over safe and sound in London, trying to figure out what to tell these guys, and they're over here being realistic and trying to stay alive. But wherever they could, I could see that they were following the instructions.
Can you briefly discuss the 1608 Anglican church in the fort, as well as those four chancel burials? And how did you match the high status men who perished during the church's existence with the burials, two of which, if I recall, featured anthropomorphic coffins and a Catholic reliquary?
Well, one of the major discoveries has been the finding of the first church. I'll call it the first real church. And that was found by looking at these soil discolorations, these huge holes that have been dug to put in huge posts to establish the largest building footprint that we found in the fort, pretty much in the center. And the other reason we think, one reason we thought it was important is that there is documentary evidence. Was the church, because there's documentary evidence how big the church was, and it was 24 by 16. Well, that's what this pattern made. And then on the eastern end, there were four graves we found. And that would be staying with English custom that the higher-ups would be buried in the chancel, the leaders. So then we excavated and found human remains in four of these burials. By the artifacts and the way they were buried and their ages at death, which could be determined forensically pretty well, it began to point to four individuals that we know died during the time that this church stood there, and it didn't stand long. It was only there about 8 years. So amongst us four were two captains, a knight, and a cleric, the minister. And so we feel that looking at other evidence in each one of the burials, like the shape of the coffins of two of them, suggested these are very high-end folks, and they actually could well be relatives of the governor that was sent over here, Sir Thomas West. They're both Wests connected. And then in one, we found on the coffin. The coffins are just stains in the ground with nail patterns. We found a small silver, as it turned out, box that had something in it. You can tell it was rattling, and we picked it up, and it had been set on the coffin, not in it. So obviously the individual in the coffin couldn't have put it on the coffin. So we felt that this might be the clue to who it is. And through many tests and high-powered CAT scanning, we were able to see what was in it without opening it. It had a little door on it, but it was corroded shut, and we didn't want to break the object. Anyway, the CAT scan told us that it would contain five splinters of human bone and a small vessel of pairs made of lead that was broken in half. That would have had, by tradition, and we're going back to look at the English tradition, would have holy water, and the bones would be considered bones of a saint. And together, that makes what's called a reliquary, which is super common in the Catholic religion, but not in the Church of England, because that was all reformed, as you know, in the middle of the 16th century. So that was surprising. So here is a Catholic, and there was a captain's leading staff broken in there, too, in that same burial. So we think that it was, and we'll go too far into the name, but we've got a name for them all, and this was a captain as well. So with forensic science and other science here, stable isotopes, DNA, one test, since the book was written, actually, points the fact that the two Wests who we thought were the Wests do have a similar, one of the tests says it's a similar DNA pattern. So that's reassuring that we know who they are. And then the final person was buried just in a winding shroud. And he was probably Reverend Robert Hunt, who would be buried very humbly. He was a humble guy, and he held the colony together, and he died at the time that he could have been buried in that church. And the other reason we think it's a cleric is that he was buried east to west. That is, his head is at the east end of the body. And then there was another one, the same one, the reliquary guy, same way. And according to one record I have, it's called Ancient English Tradition, that only clerics are buried with their head to the east, laying towards the east, and everyone else is laying towards the west. And there's some explanation for that, but we'll get into it anyway. It's in the book, and so we think that the reliquary guy had his captain Gabriel Archer, who landed in 1607, went back to England, came back. And may have become a lay priest. And Catholicism may have been more common here than people have thought in the past. within the church, people sort of hanging on to their tradition, going to the, they have to go to church every day here, still going to the Anglican church, but, you know, they got their connection with God, physical connections that is so common with Catholics.
So we've arrived at Jane, 14-year-old Jane. Who was Jane? How did you find her in the storehouse cellar? And why and how did forensic anthropologists conclude that she had experienced postmortem cannibalism, possibly as the storied powdered wife?
Well, the cannibalism story is part of the Starving Time, 69-1610 story. And there it's mentioned by the resident governor, who was eyewitness, and a couple of other, and John Smith, who wasn't there, but he wrote about it, and some other company officials who I don't think they were there in at the time. But anyway, there was the accounts that said that a few people resorted to cannibalism. And then there's a story of a man that killed his wife and was caught with, she had been, this is kind of gross, dismembered. And he just said, well, no, you look on, this is Starving Time. She just died. Well, he was executed because he had murdered her. And so whether or not that's part of cannibalism or not, but what we found was a mutilated human skull and a severed leg bone in this Starving Time layer in one of the cellars. So in looking at the forensic evidence of what someone did to this skull, it is no doubt in my mind, this is one of the most sure discoveries besides the fort of what we found, is that all of the soft tissue, including her brain, was removed by knife cutting and chopping and processing, just like you would an animal. The same with the leg bone. So it turns out that you could forensically tell this was a 14 to 15-year-old girl. Stable isotopes say she was English, that she was from the the southern coast, maybe, of England, by what she ate. Probably came over with the 300 plus or 400 people that came in right before the Starving Time and basically caused it. It probably didn't live very long. But there's evidence that she was already dead when this was done. She wasn't killed to eat, and they weren't doing that. It's just one guy. That was really taboo, you know. Cannibalism, not really. But it makes you, to me, it gives me empathy to what it was like to be at Jamestown. Really like to be at Jamestown. It materializes the story. It's not how they survived at all. But the conditions were just sort of unthought of by the company that sent them over. And it didn't happen again, according to record, and we haven't found any evidence of it. So it's just a lesson, you know, that this establishing a colony is a very complicated endeavor. And I see a lot of parallels now, and I won't go there completely, but we're talking about going to Mars. Well, there's a hostile environment for you and how long it takes and all that kind of thing. But that's not an easy thing to do either. And this is kind of that was going on. Imagine the English didn't know what was on the other side of the ocean, really, what they would get into, and then adapted, but in one case, they didn't adapt fast enough.
What were some of the causes of the cannibalism during the Starving Time? And was Jane one of the poorer sort?
There are a couple names, but I don't think there's not enough evidence to say what it is. But right now, DNA is a data bank, as I understand it, in England, are beginning to see that certain regions and villages, towns, which people don't really move away from over centuries, and that they have certain DNA patterns that we may be able to find. So this research, I'm working on a third book. The research never ends. You know, I mean, it's one evidence comes up and it'll lead you somewhere else. And it, to me, it is so similar to a crime scene investigation, modern. A very cold case, obviously, but a case. And try to look for the physical evidence to tell you what happened in the past. And it's a lot of it's speculation, but you do have evidence that begins to point to logical conclusion. And I guess the reader is the jury. And I try to put all that evidence into the book. Say, well, it's this way, it could be this, but it could be that. And leave it up to the reader to decide.
What about, this is sort of a follow-up to that, what about the slate that included words and images, including evidence of Harriet Algonquin phonetics in the 1608 to 09 well? And why did you attribute, do you attribute the slate to William Strachey, or do you attribute it to many people, as well as perhaps the cotton pipe stems?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious it's several people, the buried slate. To me, I was so excited. I'm a historian, and that's like finding a book. You know, it was written on this piece of writing slate over many long time period, or different people. Because you can see different angles that they were holding it with when they were making drawings of birds and other animals, trees, text, you know, sentences. All of these things are jumbled onto it. And in one case, there are three rampant lions. They've got lions on their back legs in a pose that is typical of coats of arms. In fact, the English coat of arms has a rampant lion on one side. So I don't think they were trying to whoever was writing on that was doing it to say it's British, but probably I was thinking the coat of arms, the crest of William Strachey, who wrote one of the most complete descriptions of the fort and descriptions of a shipwreck that Shakespeare apparently used for the Tempest play. that seemed to point to him, and he had been shipwrecked in Bermuda, and on his, the slate are drawings of a palmetto tree, or I think it's a palmetto tree, and then a type of bird that only lives in Bermuda. It's called a cajal. We found those bones here, by the way. They use them. They ate them when the group of settlers came from Bermuda via a shipwreck to Jamestown. So here, you know, I think, and then there's a sentence at the end that said, "I am not of the finest sort," and it's sort of lamenting, it seems to me. And you can see in William Strachey's life that he ran around with people like Shakespeare and was with the higher ups, but in the end, he thought he was going to inherit a lot of money from his father, and father died broke, so he didn't. And so I could just see him writing that down, you know, perhaps. But again, the reader, be the jury. Is this enough evidence to say who this is? I'm not saying, just saying it's possible, or probable, I should say. In this case, probable, because you have several pieces of evidence lining up. So we try to go from the possible to the probable and lay out the evidence. And in any case, it's all, to me, it all materializes a story that's only, basically had only been known intellectually by words, but it's places. And I guess we archaeologists put together the scenery of a play, or not a play, but you know what I mean, the action where the script is incomplete, the written script, but the atmosphere, the scene is reconstructed from the physical evidence that is left from whatever action took place.
Thank you for being on the show. The book is Jamestown, The Truth Revealed, out by University of Virginia Press. On behalf of Dr. William Kelso, the New Books Network, the Archaeology Channel, this is Ryan Tripp. Tune in next time.